think that we can start now. Lovely to see so many people here. I'm very pleased to have Keith Whiteland to talk to us. Keith has recently retired from the position of Head of Biblical Studies at Sheffield University. I realise a lot of people know this already, forgive me for the other people that don't. And is still continuing with his directorship of the independent publishing company, the Sheffield Phoenix Press, and his editorship of the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament. Obviously, the reason that we were interested in having him talk to PSC tonight is one of his several books, The Invention of Ancient Israel, The Silencing of Palestinian History. Its publication within the biblical studies context meant that the issue of Palestine, and therefore the question of Israel's history, has been brought to the fore in what some people might think of otherwise a non-political discipline. The book, I thought this was very interesting. The book has been reprinted three times, twice in 2001, once in 2003, and was published in Korea in 2003 and Greece in 2008. It was chosen by Edward Said as one of his two books of the year in the Times Literary Supplement, but unsurprisingly had a mixture of uncomplimentary as well as complimentary reviews. Professor Whiteland is currently co-editing a collection of essays due out later this year called The Politics of Israel's Past, Biblical Archaeology and Nation Building in Israel-Palestine. So obviously another title to look forward to, and as is this talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the introduction and the invitation, and thank you to those who have come along to brave the temperatures and the ice, especially as I suspect that when many of you first saw the list of events, you were probably wondering, well, what does somebody who's been involved in biblical studies for 30 years have to really contribute to the concerns of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign? Well, it might come as a surprise to some of you that biblical scholars have been involved in a political controversy over the past 15 to 20 years about how the past has been used to support the dispossession of the Palestinians. It has at times been a particularly nasty debate, with personal vilification and all kinds of charges thrown around, such as being pro-Palestinian, heaven forbid, anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. Some of this has leaked out into the public domain through articles in the press, the odd popular book, and some TV programmes, but most of it's remained behind closed doors. The charges of being anti-Israel and anti-Semitic tell you that the political stakes are high. The issues that have been raised are very sensitive and are seen by those who wish to maintain the status quo as politically dangerous. If you've been following recent events, and particularly the Republican primaries in the US, you may have seen Newt Gingrich's recent claim that the Palestinians are an invented people. Gingrich was appearing in an interview on the Jewish Channel, which is a US cable TV channel. In response to the question, "Do you consider yourself to be a Zionist?" which you might expect the answer to be yes or no, Gingrich replied, "Israel has the right to a state." He then went on to say, "Remember, there was no Palestine as a state. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. And I think that we've invented the Palestinian people, who are in fact Arabs and are historically part of the Arab community. And they had a chance to go many places." He then says, "Barack Obama's effort to treat the Palestinians the same as the Israelis is, as he puts it, favouring the terrorists." Now, there are lots of responses one could make to Newt Gingrich about his grasp of history or how national identity is constructed, and most people's are invented, or his definition of equality of treatment. And I suspect that many in this room haven't noticed Obama's even-handed treatment of the Palestinians. I did notice that one commentator, in remarking about the Republican primaries, said that in most civilized societies, they care for their mentally ill. In the US, apparently, they make them debate on television. The problem is that Gingrich is repeating a long-standing claim made, for instance, by Golda Meir, that the Palestinians do not exist. It was made popular in the 1980s in a book by Joan Peters called From Time Immemorial. And this was a very scholarly-looking book with lots of footnotes that was a bestseller in the USA and on the bestseller list for some time. It purported to show, from various archives and documents and a wealth of evidence, that the Palestinians were all recent immigrants into Jewish settled areas, into Palestine during the British Mandate from 1920 to 48. The book was eventually discredited by Norman Finkelstein some years ago, who showed that much of the evidence and much of the archive material had simply been fabricated. Unfortunately, the effect can still be seen with people like Gingrich repeating the claim as though it's a historical fact. But what underlies his claim, more importantly, is the idea that a nation without a past is a contradiction in terms. If the Palestinians don't possess a past, they cannot possess a national consciousness, be a people, and therefore they have no right to a land or a state. The corollary, of course, is that they can then be expelled with no problem about moral concerns. Let me give you a couple of other examples to show how Palestine's past is relevant to its present and its future. In his address to the Knesset on the 60th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel, George Bush claimed that what followed was more than the establishment of a new country. It was the redemption of an ancient promise given to Abraham and Moses and David, a homeland for the chosen people of Eretz Yisrael. For Bush, as for many American politicians like Gingrich, the modern state has a past, and that past is described in the Bible. For them, this is the return to a God-given land. The other example of how these ideas and beliefs are woven into the very fabric of American culture and politics comes from Bill Clinton's memoirs, where he revealed that the night before the meeting with Arafat and Begin on the White House lawn on the 14th of September 1993, he'd stayed up until the early hours of the morning reading the Bible, the book of Exodus in particular. As with Gingrich, Bush, and countless other American politicians of all persuasions, Clinton believed that these biblical stories put him in touch with the real history of the region. What we're dealing with is a series of very powerful images about the past that are derived from a religiously inspired view of history, which is shared by Christianity and Judaism. That combination makes them all the more potent, particularly in American politics, US politics. These are the stories of Moses and the escape from slavery in Egypt, the conquest of Canaan by Joshua, and the taking of the Promised Land, and then the establishment of a monarchy, or a state, as it's often referred to, under David and Solomon, centred in Jerusalem. Gingrich, in justifying his claim that Israel is or was a state, says that Jews have been in Jerusalem for the last 3,000 years, a reference to the story of David and his capture of Jerusalem in the Bible. Another very powerful image, which we'll come back to later on. Israel has a past, and so it has a present as a modern state. Palestine has no past and so no present. For people like Gingrich, the Exodus and conquest are understood as stories of liberation from slavery and persecution and possession of a God-given land. That image resonates even more in American politics because it's the same image of the founding of the US, the escape from persecution, the conquest of the promised land. No mention in either case is made of those who have been dispossessed of their land or their past. I know it's not a particularly good image, but it will just illustrate a couple of points. In order to understand just how deep-seated these images are and why they're so difficult to dislodge, we need to go back a few centuries. And what we've got here is a map of Palestine drawn by the British cartographer John Speed from 1611. And Speed produced an atlas in 1611 called the Theatre of the Empire of Great Britain, which included detailed maps of the counties of England along with those of Scotland, Wales and Ireland. It was then later expanded in 1627 with a new section called A Prospect of the Most Famous Parts of the World, containing maps of other parts of the world, including a map of Palestine, which was at the very end of the atlas, and this is the map. Now, although in the atlas he claims to be, and these were his words, presenting an exact geography of the Kingdom of England, Scotland, Ireland and the Isles adjoining, what's noted about his map of Palestine is that, and you can't quite see it, but it features the route of the Exodus and then Palestine divided up amongst the 12 tribes after it's been conquered by Joshua. And then there's an inset of Jerusalem in the corner. This is not a real place. It doesn't have contemporary inhabitants, towns, or villages. It's an imagined land based on the biblical images of the Exodus and the conquest. But he's drawn it as though it's a typical English county. And there's Lincolnshire in his atlas. Sorry, I don't have a map of Yorkshire, but Lincolnshire is where I grew up, which is why I took the image myself. And if you look down in the on the edge of the Wash in the Fens, that's where I grew up. But he drew Palestine very much in the mode of an English county. And like Lincolnshire, for instance, it includes an inset of its major towns, and it's decorated with the same symbols for towns and villages, historic events, and off the coast, when you can see the details, ships and a large fish. Now, the ship and the large fish is a recurrent image in many of these maps from Speed onwards, and particularly with Palestine, alludes to the story of Jonah and the so-called whale in the Bible. But in Speed's map of Palestine, one of the interesting features is that the ship off the coast here, when you can actually see the detail, is flying the English ensign. So it's actually part of the English Navy sitting off the coast. And Speed describes Great Britain as the very Eden of Europe, a land flowing with milk and honey, the biblical phrase, and says there's no land like it except that conquered by Joshua and divided among the tribes. In Speed's atlas, then, Palestine's already part of the empire, 300 years or more before General Allenby's entrance into Jerusalem in 1917. And maps like Speed's over the next few centuries continue this kind of theme. They're often drawn with these images of Exodus, conquest, division amongst the tribes, etc., various biblical themes. Palestine, in these maps, is never a contemporary place. It's the stage on which the biblical events have been or are being acted out. But Palestine has already been appropriated and incorporated into European domains through these images in Bibles and atlases long before the European expansion in the 18th and 19th centuries. So the images become very important in terms of that notion of appropriation. And it was Napoleon's invasion of Egypt and campaign in Palestine that opened up the region to missionaries, scholars, and wealthy Western tourists. Yet when they arrived by steamer, they brought with them the same kinds of fantasies and imaginations that we see in Speed's map and other maps. They had no interest in the contemporary inhabitants of the land or their past, whether that was Islamic history or much earlier periods. Like in Speed's maps or map, the contemporary inhabitants were simply extras on the stage on which the biblical events had been acting out. And these tourists came searching for the biblical past. That's what they wanted to see, that's what they wanted to experience. And Thomas Cook's advert in 1869 for his, which was the first proposed tour to Palestine, 1868, says, "It is a joyous event to see the mountains round about Jerusalem, but its culminating glory would be to look beyond those mountain ranges to the Jerusalem above. And if a tour to famed attractions in Palestine should inspire all who accompany us to seek the better land, a rich reward crowns our labours. Visitors to Jerusalem and Palestine were being actively encouraged to replace the reality they might find with the Jerusalem of their own desires and imaginations. The reasons for this is then revealed in Cook's Tourist Handbook for Palestine and Syria, first published in 1891. Where, when describing the itinerary, we find this passage. "Most travellers have a feeling of disappointment on first seeing Jerusalem. Its magnitude is so much less than the imagination had pictured. Associated as it is with the grandest and most sacred events of history, it's difficult to feel this little town, around whose walls you may walk in an hour, is the holy city." So the physical reality that confronted the travellers could not possibly match the images and expectations they brought with them from England or elsewhere. Such travellers, apart from a few notable exceptions, remained virtually ignorant of the real lives of local notables, merchants, peasants, nomads, etc., or their deep attachment to the land. There's an advert for a tour to the Holy Land in conjunction with the World Sunday School Convention, which was held in Jerusalem in April 1904. And the advert says, "For those who profess the Christian faith, no other land possesses a little of the attraction of Palestine. It is no exaggeration to say that the dream of the lives of thousands is to tread the streets down which the Saviour peacefully walked, to stand on hallowed spots associated with the grandest and most sacred events of history. In a word, to wander within the walls of the holy city of Jerusalem." Now, if you're tempted to think that this is an interesting relic of the past that has no relevance to the contemporary struggle, then I invite you to attend or visit the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida. It's a multi-million dollar venture funded by Zion's Hope, an evangelical Christian organisation. It opened in 2001 and it's marketed as the Living Biblical History Museum. And just like Thomas Cook's clients, you can walk on the streets where Jesus walked. You can visit the temple. And you can even visit the caves where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. And it says here, When you pass through our city gate, you will travel back in time to an ancient land that's 2,000 years old and 7,000 miles away. That depends where you start from, of course. In the street market of Jerusalem, browse the Middle Eastern marketplace. See the city well, begin a walking tour of the experience and interact with Jerusalem's own streets and merchants. But again, it's a fantasy land. An imagined place that's presented as though it's real. But it's a place where the lived realities of the inhabitants of Jerusalem are erased. It's a construction of the Orient as fantasy, a world sanitized of real inhabitants or their indigenous cultures. And it says at the top that the day at the Holy Land experience will satisfy your spiritual appetite. But there's no need to ignore your physical hunger. So if while on your tour you're thirsty or hungry, you can drop into the Oasis Palms Cafe, where you can get a camel cooler or a Goliath burger. But there's also a very long history of these kinds of exhibits and parks, particularly in the USA, that go back to, for example, the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904, which included a full-scale replica of Ottoman Jerusalem over 11 acres. Thousands of visitors who had never set foot in Jerusalem, or never would set foot in Jerusalem, could experience what was described as the reality of the city for themselves. These are powerful images that have helped to erase the contemporary inhabitants, their culture and their past, and they're still being reiterated. And the focus is solely on a biblical past. Now, the European expansion also opened up Palestine to much more extensive archaeological exploration. The European powers who were competing to control the land for strategic reasons were also competing to own and control Palestine's past. Political and economic power is never sufficient alone to maintain imperial adventures. It also requires cultural power. And what the British, French and Germans were trying to do was to claim Palestine as their own God-given patrimony. What's become known as biblical archaeology, which developed in the period, archaeology in the sense in support of the Bible trying to prove the biblical traditions, was the instrument used to justify imperial claims of the competing European powers in the region. It's what one commentator termed a quiet extension of the Eastern Question waged on the battlefield of the past. So that political fight that was going on between the British, French, Germans and others as the European question was actually also being carried out in terms of the scholarly traditions, particularly in archaeology. And it's in this context that the great European national archaeological societies were actually founded in Palestine, and the first excavations of Palestinian sites were undertaken. And just like tourists on Cook's tours, many of these early archaeologists were looking to confirm the biblical stories. They're only interested in the biblical past and ignored other periods going back to the Bronze Age or periods from the Arab invasion through to the Ottoman period. The Bible acted as a guidebook for pilgrim, traveller, scholar alike in their exploration of what had become known as the Land of the Bible. There's a huge number of popular and scholarly accounts published during this time that really helped to justify this claim to Palestine as the rightful inheritance of the various Western powers through its religious connections, Christianity. Palestine's strategic importance to Britain in the struggle with France for the control of the region was the crucial factor in the founding of the Palestine Exploration Fund in London in 1865. And at a public meeting to support the setting up of the fund, the Archbishop of York had this to say: "This country of Palestine belongs to you and me. It is essentially ours. It was given to the Father of Israel in the words, 'Walk the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee.' We mean to walk through Palestine in the length and the breadth of it, because that land has been given unto us. It's the land from which comes news of our redemption. It's the land towards which we turn as the foundation of all our hopes. It's the land to which we may look with as true a patriotism as we do to this dear old England, which we love so much." Notice he uses the same term as George Bush was later to use, redemption. But this time, it's not Israel's return to the land, but Britain's right to return as part of its God-given inheritance through Christianity. Now, the great monument to the Palestine Exploration Fund, the PEF, is the survey of Western Palestine that produced the first detailed maps of the region. It's a trigonometrical survey which was carried out produced a whole series of very detailed maps. Now, it was designed on the one hand to illuminate the land of the Bible and identify sites associated with the biblical past. But on the other hand, it was funded by the War Office as part of Britain's strategic interests in the region, and it proved invaluable in Allenby's campaign in 1917. And it was carried out by officers of the Royal Engineers, including Conder, Kitchener and T.E. Lawrence, great names in Imperial British history. Now, maps such as these allowed the territory to be viewed, controlled and, in a sense, ordered. And when it was finished, Conder remarked that Palestine is now brought home to England. And what we have here is a potent mix of military power and religious conviction. And it's the same mix we see in American politics today that governs its dealings with the region. Now, this struggle for territory, as I said, is never simply about the power of military force. I mean, as Edward Said was very fond of pointing out, it's also about ideas, images, and imaginings. And these images and imaginings, this imagination, played a crucial role in the ideological justification for Britain's successful campaign in Palestine. And when Allenby entered Jerusalem in December 1917, he described it as delivering a Christmas present to the British people. And the front cover of Punch famously carried a picture of Allenby depicted dressed as a crusader, gazing down on Jerusalem, and the caption underneath was, "The Last Crusade." The establishment of the British Mandate, which then followed, opened up Palestine to even more extensive archaeological exploration. And the New York Times carried an editorial on the 8th of February 1928 with the headline, "Reconquering Canaan." And the claim in the article was that the archaeologist is repossessing the Promised Land. So archaeology was used very much in terms of ideological justification. The growing archaeological exploration of the region, and in particular this emergence of what became known as biblical archaeology, offered the promise now, really for the first time, that the events of the biblical narratives would now be verified by the spade of the archaeologist. What followed in the next couple of decades or more, the picture that was built up by these scholars was of an ancient Israel coming from outside, taking over the land, and eventually creating a nation state under David in Jerusalem, basically confirming the biblical narratives. But it was a picture that was built on the notion of evolutionary development of society, whereby it was seen as inevitable that, quote, the superior Israelites would replace inferior Canaanites. But what these scholars actually constructed was a mirror image of their own times and their own situation when the European nation state was seen as the pinnacle of political evolution. In essence, they read their own contemporary present back into Palestine's past and then used it as ideological justification for their own imperial adventures. The Zionist movement from the 19th century onwards then drew on this view of history in order to show that they were returning to and reclaiming their historical homeland and eventually reclaiming their right to a state. In a sense, they were usurping the claim of the European powers and taking over this ideological justification as their claim to the land. And archaeology in the 1950s in Israel played an important role in connecting the newly found nation with its ancient past and establishing its claim to the land. One eyewitness described it in this way. Suddenly people could see things that had never been tangible before. There was a feeling that this piece of ground for which people had suffered so much wasn't just any plot of land, but a piece of earth where their forefathers had lived 1,500 to 2,000 years ago. Their work in the present was cast in a different light. Their history was revealed to them, and they saw it with their own eyes. The Bible, then, not only described the past, but also acted as the title deed to the land. And so an ultranationalist settler in Hebron, for instance, can claim, here, right here, God promised Abraham the land of Israel. Just imagine to yourself that I go to sleep at the very place where Abraham used to get up every morning. His view is not very much different from the European tourists who came with Thomas Cook in the 19th century and early 20th centuries. But now it was no longer Europe's God-given patrimony, but Israel's. The Bible was now Israel's title deed to the land. The words of the Proclamation of Independence of the State of Israel, issued on the 14th of May 1948, declared that this was a return to the land of their fathers and the re-establishment of a Jewish state. The carefully selected guests who attended the Jerusalem 3000 celebrations on the 4th of September 1995 found this in their programmes. No other people designated Jerusalem as its capital in such an absolute and binding manner. Jerusalem is the concrete historical expression of the Jewish religion and its inheritance on the one hand, and of the independence and sovereignty of the Jewish people on the other. Jerusalem's identity as a spiritual and national symbol at one and the same time has forged the unique and eternal bond between this city and the Jewish people, a bond that has no parallel in the annals of nations. Israel's rule over the united city has allowed her to bloom and prosper, and despite the problems between the communities within her, she has not enjoyed such centrality and importance since her days as the capital of the Kingdom of Israel, referring back to the biblical traditions. Now, there's no mention here, of course, that Jerusalem has a history stretching back centuries to the early Bronze Age, around 3000 BCE, 2 millennia before the period when David is supposed to have made it his capital. The claim of historic right to return and the establishment of the modern state rests upon this idea that there's a direct line between the biblical past and the present. It's the reason why Chaim Weizmann tried to alter the wording of the Balfour Declaration from the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people to the re-establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. So that in his words, these are his words, the historical connection with the ancient tradition would be indicated. It's a claim that's been so successful that it's repeated by Bush, Gingrich and many others. It's a claim and a view of history that can be heard constantly in utterances of official Israeli government spokespersons or found on countless official and unofficial websites. So what we see from this quick potted history is that the history of Palestine has suffered from a double bind of imperial and colonial control. The construction of national histories from the 19th century onwards, and particularly after World War II, has been understood by most modern nations as an expression of national consciousness and sovereignty. But what's peculiar here, and it's probably possibly unique, is that with the retreat of the European powers, particularly the British, the post-colonial history that's been written was not undertaken by the indigenous population, but by a new colonial power. It was a reflection and reinforcement of what had gone before. It was a colonial Zionist narrative, which as a European enterprise in its origins, simply reiterated and reinforced the notion of external conquest and the bringing of culture and civilization to the region. Palestine lost its history first to the European imperial powers and then to a Zionist construction of the past, which rapidly became its national narrative. The history of Palestine became embedded under two layers of colonial history, layers which are so thick they're almost impenetrable. Now, the reason that the debate, which I mentioned at the beginning, has been so violent in recent years is because it challenged this view of history and these powerful images. When the Israeli archaeologist Ziv Herzog published a letter in the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz in 1999, entitled "Deconstructing the Walls of Jericho," he created a political storm. He was reiterating what was a fairly standard view within biblical studies at the time, although controversial, but it had become clear from the archaeology that the villages which had first been excavated and people had pointed to and said that they're excavated in the hill country, mostly the West Bank, which were pointed to and said, well, this is where the Israelites settled when they came in from outside. And there were some urban centres around, towns which had showed evidence of destruction. Here we have evidence of Joshua coming in from outside and the Israelites then settling in these villages. But what became clear over a period of time is that these villages were in fact indigenous settlements. The population in these villages had not come from outside, they'd come from within Palestine itself, when it was part of the breakup of the local economy and people are moving away into the hill country for rural settlements as a kind of risk reduction. And besides that, it also became clear that Jerusalem, at the time when it was supposed to be the capital of a major state under David, from what archaeological remains we had, was little more than a very small highland town. Now Herzog, what Herzog wrote in his letter to Haaretz is the following. This is what archaeologists have learned from their excavations in the land of Israel. The Israelites never were in Egypt, did not wander in the desert, did not conquer the land in a military campaign, and did not pass it on to the 12 tribes of Israel. Perhaps even harder to swallow, he says, is that the united monarchy of David and Solomon, which is described in the Bible as a regional power, was at most a small tribal kingdom. As I say, it created a political storm when it was first published. And he was denounced by Tommy Lapid, who was then Minister for Justice and Deputy Prime Minister, but he's also leader of the Shinui Party, which describes itself as the only active liberal political party in Israel. And he was denounced by Lapid for undermining the security of Israel and providing ammunition to Israel's enemies. Haaretz then published a response, I think probably the next day, but shortly after, by Herschel Shanks, who's the editor of Biblical Archaeology Review, which is a magazine aimed at the conservative Christian market in the USA. And Shanks complained that Herzog had aligned himself with a group of European scholars who, we said, are motivated by interests other than pure scholarship. Some, he said, are serious scholars, but most of them have a political agenda. At the extreme, they can even be viewed as anti-Semitic. One of their number has written a book entitled The Invention of Ancient Israel, The Silencing of Palestinian History. That about says it all. What all this shows is that apart from the political arguments that go on and need to go on, there's also an important cultural argument that has to be made to counter the images that are so deeply ingrained in the West and which underpin the Zionist construction of the past. It's important to challenge the kind of crass statements made by politicians such as Gingrich, because if they're not challenged, they simply become accepted as historical fact. They're self-evident. It's essentially a fight for history, for an alternative view of the history of ancient Palestine. The reactions to the challenges to the standard view of the history, which we see in the response to Herzog's letter, and there's a lot more that could be cited, which is much more vitriolic and less pleasant, shows just how important the issue is. Palestine and Palestinians have a past that needs to be written from the ancient past to the present and put together as a coherent story, not one that just starts in the 19th century or during the period of the British Mandate, but one that goes back millennia to the Bronze Age and stretches through to the present. Edward Said recognised the power of these images of the past and also the power of the appeal to the biblical past, particularly in Western cultures, and the success of the Zionist movement in rewriting the history of Palestine so as to exclude the indigenous inhabitants and their cultures. We cannot afford, he said, so grievous a gap in our national life. Thank you.